well, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me welcome you here to this meeting of the Global Security Forum in a slightly different room at a different time today for logistical reasons. Also a different chairman, and I offer the apologies of Lord Lothian, Michael Ancram, who has to be in Scotland at the moment, so he asked me to chair this meeting. My name is Michael Clark. I'm one of the on the committee, the advisory committee of GSF, and very pleased to be so. We're here to hear Professor Michael Mandelbaum talk about his book, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth. There are copies available at a very reasonable rate, and he said he will sign some copies afterwards. And it is a great pleasure for me to introduce Michael Mandelbaum. It's a personal pleasure as well, because I've been a reader of his books for many, many years. He's the Christian Herter Professor of American Foreign Policy at SITE, the School of Advanced International Studies in Washington. He has taught at Columbia and Harvard. He's taught at Annapolis at the Naval College. He's been a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He is a member of the board of the Washington Institute on the Near East. More than anything to those of us in Britain, he's a great friend of Britain. He's here quite frequently, and he's spoken before at the GSF. I think it was in 2016, wasn't it, last time, before we had our latest round of the present nervous breakdown that we're going through, and he observes what happens in Britain more rather interestingly. But in general in Britain, I think we know him as an author. I first started reading his work in the late 70s, early 80s. We were talking about the nuclear trilogy, which he said, told me his wife should have been called the Hiroshima trilogy. It's about the nuclear question, the nuclear revolution, and the nuclear future. And he wrote, he's written a number of books on American foreign policy, mission, failed mission, or why it is that America cannot succeed in the system that it itself set up. A couple of the books that really worked on me was The Dawn of Peace in Europe in about 1996, I think it was, and Ideas That Conquered the World. In The Dawn of Peace in Europe, he finishes off by saying that by a mixture of luck and judgment, Europe is on the verge of a real deep peace. But we could mess it up. Isn't that the truth? It's not inevitable. We could mess it up. And in Ideas That Conquered the World, he's not embarrassed to speak about democracy and peace and capitalist free trade development as ideas that have a perpetual power if we're prepared to use them properly. And what I love about Michael Mandelbaum's work is that he's what I would call a hard-nosed optimist. His analysis is both political science and history, but he's very hard-nosed. But he's optimistic. It's easy to be a pessimist. Pessimists are either right or they're happy. And, you know, it's always said a pessimist is a well-informed optimist. Well, no. Michael Mandelbaum is a very, very well-informed and distinguished optimist. And it is the freshness and the optimism and the belief in what he talks about in his books that I find so excellent. And so this book is very much in the theme of all of the themes he deals with. This particular theme is the one that I treasure most in his writing, The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth. So I'm really looking forward to hearing him give us a presentation on this, and then we'll have Q&A afterwards. I suspect when he's on these European tours, he probably thinks he's got away from his students, but actually you haven't. You've got a room full of them. And I suspect that you will find this more or less everywhere you go in the United Kingdom. Michael Mandelbaum.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for that most generous introduction, and thank you all for coming. I had the privilege of addressing the Global Strategy Forum 3 years ago upon the publication of my previous book called Mission Failure, America and the World in the Post-Cold War Era, and that book concerned American foreign policy after the end of the Cold War. This book is about what was happening in the rest of the world. And The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth is organized around a particular question. And that question is, what are the prospects for peace? Always a timely question, and I will give my answer in the course of my remarks, but that question begs a previous question, not often asked, but which I do address in The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, which, as I say, I'll be happy to sign for you if you're interested in purchasing a copy. It's a previous question, and it informs my analysis. And that question is, what is peace? How do we define peace? Well, the obvious answer is peace is the absence of war, and that's always a good thing. But by that definition, the world has been an extremely peaceful place in the sense that for most countries, for most of their history, they've been, by this definition, peaceful because, as we know, war is episodic, not constant. And that definition seems to me, although a common sense definition, doesn't fully capture an important reality of international politics. So I have a different and somewhat more rigorous definition with which I work in this book, and that is peace is the absence not only of war, but of the imminent prospect of war, of urgent and expensive preparations for war, of conducting foreign policy under the looming shadow of war. It's the absence of what political scientists call security competition. And while war has not been constant in history, security competition has been. There have been no or very few periods where it was not a central feature of the foreign policies of virtually every country. What I mean by peace, or one might call it deep peace, is captured by a no parking sign I once saw that said, "Don't even think of parking here." Well, peace, as I'm defining it, is when the major powers don't seriously think about war in the way that they usually do. When war has fallen to the bottom of their national agendas, if not off it entirely. Now, by this definition, there has, in my judgment, been only one period of deep peace, and that period was the 25 years following the opening of the Berlin Wall, which is a convenient point for dating the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the post-Cold War era. Now, you might think there's something perhaps eccentric about deeming this period one of deep peace, since after all, there was plenty of violence in Central Africa, in the Balkans, in Syria. But I designated a period of uniquely deep peace because the death and destruction that came about was caused mainly by governments oppressing their own people or by warring militias and not, and this is crucial, through pitched battles between and among powerful states using the most advanced weapons, which is historically the cause of the greatest death and destruction. And not only did the strongest states not fight with one another, they didn't think, at least as seriously as they usually think, about going to war. I wouldn't say war disappeared from their agendas, but it was seriously demoted. Now, why was this? I don't think that this was accidental. Rather, I argue in The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth that it was due to the robust presence of three peace-promoting features of international relations. The first was the benign hegemony of the United States. Even governments that didn't like American primacy were not disposed to challenge it for most of these 25 years. The second peace-promoting feature was economic interdependence. This was, after all, one of the great ages of globalization. And we know that countries that trade with and invest in one another on a large scale are very reluctant to go to war because it costs them money. The third major peace-promoting feature of the post-Cold War era was democracy. This was also the great age of democracy. It was the era when, to take the subtitle of my 2004 book about democracy, the title of which is democracy's good name, the rise and risks of the world's most popular form of government, this was the era in which, for the very first time, democracy became the most popular form of government in the world. Democracies, indeed, outnumbered non-democracies, although not by a great margin. Now, I should say that by democracy here, I mean what I regard and what I explain in Democracy's Good Name as a hybrid system, the merger of two traditions which for most of modern history were regarded as incompatible. Democracy entails popular sovereignty, free, fair, regular elections, but it also crucially includes liberty. You don't have democracy without genuine liberty, at least democracy as we understand it in the West. And liberty comes in three varieties. There's economic liberty, which happens to be the oldest, dating back to ancient Rome, which means private property. There's religious liberty, that is freedom of worship, and then there's political liberty, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. Democracy promotes peace, as I argue in Democracy's Good Name, and I re-argue in this book, in a variety of ways. Democracy gives the people some purchase, some control over their sometimes bellicose rulers and leaders. Moreover, democracy is, among other things, and perhaps preeminently, a political system for resolving conflicts and disputes, which are inevitable in any society, resolving them peacefully without recourse to violence. And the habit of the peaceful resolution of conflict, when transposed to the international sphere, when practiced in relations with other countries, leads to peace. So these three forces made the world, in my judgment, uniquely peaceful. Now, I am not arguing that these three peace-promoting forces, singly or even together, can guarantee peace. And the reason for that is nothing can guarantee peace. In the political sphere, nothing can guarantee anything. There are no iron laws of politics like the laws of physics. So think of these three peace-promoting features as modular blocks that, when stacked one on top of the other, create a formidable barrier against war. That's what happened in the post-Cold War era. The golden age of peace, as I see it, is, however, over. It's in the past. Security competition has returned, and so has the prospect, although not so far, thankfully, the reality of war between and among the most powerful states. It returned because one country in each of three important regions undertook policies designed to achieve dominance in that region through the use of force. In Europe, Russia invaded and occupied Ukraine. In East Asia, China laid claim, contrary to international law, to most of the Western Pacific Ocean, built islands, artificial islands there, and contrary to the promises of the Chinese leadership, put military installations on those islands. In the Middle East, Iran extended its influence by organizing and sustaining paramilitary groups that have worked to undermine the governments of several of those regions, and Iran also pursued, and I think in some sense is still pursuing, nuclear weapons. The three major chapters that are at the heart of the rise and fall of peace on Earth describe and explain how peace turned back to security competition over 25 years in each of these three regions. So this book is, in some sense, an international history of the three major crucial regions over 25 years. And in each case, the story is a complicated one. Otherwise, this book would have been much shorter. There are multiple reasons in all three cases for the return to an aggressive foreign policy. But the three have, I argue, one feature in common. In each of them, the aggressive foreign policy that ended peace had a particular domestic cause. Each of the governments of the disturbers of the peace was and is a dictatorship, and its rule in each case rests ultimately on coercion, but for a variety of reasons, each of these dictatorships sought and still seeks as much genuine popular support and political legitimacy as it can get. And there is real popular support in all three countries, perhaps not majority support, and we don't really know how broad it is because the regimes will never put it to the test. But nonetheless, each of them is concerned about popular support, and in each case, especially in the Chinese and Russian cases, the familiar, reliable source of political support began to appear a wasting asset. Both Russia and China, both dictatorial regimes, benefited from economic growth, but the prospects for economic growth turned grim in the second decade of this century. In Russia, economic growth depends very heavily on the price of energy on global markets. Russia is really a one-crop economy. It has only one thing that anybody else wants to buy, and that's energy. During Vladimir Putin's first spell as president, the price of oil went from about $24 a barrel on the global market to $132 a barrel. It skyrocketed. Money poured in. Now, Putin kept a large share of it for himself and his cronies, but there was enough to spread around to the Russian people. Living standards rose, incomes increased. Putin was very popular. But when he returned to office, the price of oil had fallen by half and shows no signs of rising to its former great height, leaving him with the need to find some alternative source of popular support. Similarly, in China, the Chinese Communist Party presided over a remarkable, indeed probably historically unprecedented, period of economic growth. Three full decades in which the Chinese economy achieved double-digit increases every year. That remarkable performance was due to three things. First, the large-scale movement of Chinese people from the countryside to the city, where they're far more productive. Second, heavy investment, especially in infrastructure. And third, ever-increasing exports. But by the second decade of this century, that formula was becoming rather threadbare. And indeed, the best information we have is that in recent years, the Chinese growth rate has fallen by half. Not quite sure, because Chinese economic statistics are not particularly reliable. But nonetheless, China is now averaging 4 or 5% growth a year. Now, for an advanced industrial society, 4 or 5% growth a year would be wonderful, marvelous. But it's not what the Chinese people have become accustomed to enjoying, and that puts pressure on the regime to attract popular support in some other way. As for Iran, it's a different case because the mullahs who took power in 1979 have never presided over a creditable economic performance. Iran has endured four decades of stagnation, but that means that the search for some alternative source of popular legitimacy becomes all the more important. So, all three needed a new source of popular legitimacy, and all three turned, in order to achieve it, to aggressive nationalism. Each of the regimes portrayed what it was doing in its neighborhood and at the expense of its neighbors to its target audience, namely the people it governed, as necessary to defend the homeland, the mother country, against the predatory designs of the democracies led by the United States, which each government argued to its own people was bent on subverting, weakening, and even destroying the country. In addition, each of these three regimes has portrayed its aggressive policies as steps to restore the country to its rightful place as the dominant power in the region. That is to say, each dictatorship ended peace as a strategy for preserving its own rule. And that is what put an end to what I see as the golden quarter century of peace as I've defined it. This raises an obvious question. How, if at all, can we restore peace? And I do have an answer in The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, although it's not a particularly satisfactory one. In my view, of the three bulwarks of peace, democracy is by far the most potent. And there have been many studies over the last three decades that show that full-fledged democracies have a powerful tendency not to go to war, at least against one another, at least since the second half of the 20th century. So, in order to restore peace, what is necessary is for Russia, China, and Iran to become full-fledged democracies, incorporating both popular sovereignty and the protection of liberty. Now, as you will all recognize, that is far more easily said than done. In fact, one of the things we've learned, and the United States has learned to its own cost over the last three decades, is that democracy cannot be imposed from without. It cannot be imported from another country. It has to have indigenous roots, and the hard job of building a democracy has to be done by the people of the country in question. So the implementation of full-fledged democracy in Russia, China, and Iran is the business and the responsibility of the Russian, the Chinese, and the Iranian people. And when, and indeed whether, they will be able to undertake that task, we have no idea. Thus, the central message of The Rise and Fall of Peace on Earth, and here I hope I live up to our chairman's description as a rational or hard-headed optimist, the message of the book is both optimistic and pessimistic. There's good news and bad news. The good news is we have a formula for peace. What could be better than that? The bad news is we don't know how to implement it. Which raises one final question that I'll address here, and that is, we cannot instill democracy in the revisionist countries, but are there things that we can do to make peace at least marginally more likely? Or, if we can't do that, to keep the world from getting worse, even if we can't make it better? And I have three suggestions. The first, which I outline in more detail in an article in the March-April issue of the journal Foreign Affairs, is to restore, refurbish, and reconstruct the Cold War policy of containment. In the Cold War, the democracies successfully contained the political ambitions and resisted the military initiatives of the Soviet Union. A 21st century version of containment would do the same for Russia, China, and Iran. Now, a refurbished policy of containment would not and could not be a carbon copy of Cold War containment. There are several fundamental differences. First, containment during the Cold War was directed at a country and a movement that posed a global threat. In this case, there are three regional threats. None of these three revisionists really operates outside its own region. Second, the Cold War, as those of us old enough to remember it know, was an ideological contest. The Soviet Union's creed of Marxism-Leninism was a plan for organizing society, politics, and the economy that the communist bloc sought to impose wherever it could. There's no equivalent now. Russia and China, although they seek greater influence for themselves, don't have a model that they're trying to impose. The Islamic Republic of Iran has one, but its version, the Shia version of Islamic fundamentalism, has no purchase outside the Islamic world, and not all that much among Sunni Muslims. Third, and very important, during the Cold War, the two antagonists had almost nothing to do with each other in economic terms. Now, in the post-Cold War era, all three challengers to the regional status quo are part of the global economy. Russia and Iran depend very heavily on the global economy. The global economy doesn't depend on them, but that's not true for China. China is a very important part of the global economy, important for others as well as for itself. Now, these three differences, in my view, make a new version of containment somewhat less parlous, somewhat less dangerous, but also more complicated. And it is unclear to me, that, and to what extent, the democracies will be willing to undertake a new version of containment. Well, a new containment is the first suggestion. The second is to take whatever modest steps are possible to weaken these three regimes at the margin, which the democracies did vis-a-vis the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And the third, and in a way the most important, because, as I argue in democracy's good name, democracy really spreads by example, it's important that the democracies maintain themselves as attractive examples of their form of government for the rest of the world. Now, none of these three suggestions, nor all of them together, can ensure democracy in Russia, China, and Iran, and therefore the return of deep peace. As I've said, the installation of democracy in these three countries has to be the work of the people of those countries. But these three things are what, in my judgment, the democracies can do to help to create the circumstances in which peace, having risen and fallen, can rise again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I realize you're struggling with the throat, so
thank you. That's not too bad.
Thanks for keeping going. Okay, we have 30 minutes for questions, so make them short and sharp, please, and we'll get through as many as we possibly can. Right, Jonathan Parrish over there.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jonathan Parrish. I was a Council of Foreign Relations Middle East fellow when you were there in the late 90s, in the Les Gulf, Europe. I was full-time.
Nice to see you again.
My question is in the form of a comment, but I'll make it quick. Containment, Iran. I believe we are now, after 3 long years, finally figuring out how to contain Iran. The Israelis are doing it in Syria through their air force and their intelligence and through depth diplomacy with Putin, between Bibi and Putin. And I believe the United States may be able to do some containing in Iraq, but that's really what's up for grabs right now. I believe Lebanon is even making noises about Hezbollah not going to war against Israel at the orders of Iran, which suggests Lebanon, Hezbollah, is contained. And now with John Bolton's latest proposals, I believe there's now an effort to contain Iran in the Gulf. Do you agree?
I do agree. I was saying before we started that in my judgment, the JCPOA, the deal with Iran of 2015, was not a good deal. It was not a good deal because it permitted what had been a cardinal principle of the United States to prevent, and that is countries like Iran getting the full fuel cycle. Because when you have that, you can make the bomb. You can enrich uranium.
It was not a good deal because the inspection provisions were woefully weak, and we really don't know what the Iranians are doing. And it was unsatisfactory because it had a terminal date, after which, and that's not all that far away, it's in the 2020s, Iran could legally get nuclear weapons. So, in principle, I think it was right for the Trump administration to get out of the deal. But, of course, even if you think a deal is a bad one, it doesn't necessarily mean that your best option is to leave it. And my criticism of the administration is that it didn't do nearly enough to try to get the Europeans on side. The effort to do so happened at a very low level. In order to have any chance of success, or at least in order to get more understanding from the Allies, it had to be at the presidential level. Given the nature of the sanctions, this separate channel that some Europeans are attempting to set up with Iran, I think is a non-starter. And the Iranians are going to be hurt quite badly by the renewed sanctions, although it has to be said that the main economic wound is self-inflicted. It's their irrational, incompetent economic system which holds them down more than anything else. The Trump policy, never quite stated this way, but I think it is the policy, is to try to put enough pressure on Iran to get a renegotiation of the deal that will be more satisfactory. And Trump, in his typical way, on the one hand, talks about bombing Iran into oblivion. On the other hand, says, I'd like to make a deal. We'd love to have Iran as part of the global economy. So he is wielding both a carrot and a stick, although not necessarily effectively. And the Navy has beefed up its presence in the Persian Gulf. And the mullahs presumably know that if they got into a shooting war with America, it would be terrible for them. I should mention one other thing. The military option, which doesn't exist vis-a-vis Russia or China because they're nuclear power. The United States can't go to war with them. But it does exist with respect to Iran. Now, that's important to state because the other would-be and now actual proliferator, North Korea, was from the beginning a circumstance where the United States never had a military option because of 10,000 artillery tubes trained on Seoul, which meant that the South Korean government would never countenance a preemptive attack against the North Korean nuclear facilities, and the United States certainly could not go to war against North Korea without the permission of the South. But the countries in a position comparable to that of South Korea vis-a-vis Iran, namely Saudi Arabia and Israel, which would be the targets of retaliatory strikes, are all for the United States using the military option. In fact, one of the puzzling and, to me, dismaying aspects of the Obama negotiations toward Iran was that he visibly, publicly, held the Israelis back rather than using this as leverage. He could have said to them privately, look, we don't want you to do this, but he shouldn't have said it publicly. In any event, and it's also true that the Israelis are fighting a war against Iran in Syria, and they're winning. And this is the first pushback that the Iranians have really had. They have had greater success in spreading their influence in their region than Russia has in Europe or even than China has in East Asia. So I think deterrence, I think on balance, deterrence has been strengthened, and so I agree with said.
Mm. Dangerous though it feels in the way it's expressed.
Well, I think, Trump doesn't express anything very well. you always wonder how much he really understands. But I think the direction, at least in my view, is the right one.
Yeah. Okay, General Carlton Smith, sir.
very much. Mike Carlton Smith, Old Soldier. Thank you very much for your fascinating talk. You've covered actually my first two questions in your last answer, in part anyway. So I think I'll come to number three, which was about democracy. In your definition of democracy, where does a referendum fit in?
The United States, the foreign policy community, has two attitudes toward Britain. One has to do with Brexit, and the views of our president, to the contrary notwithstanding, most of the people who follow this are opposed to Brexit for the simple reason that in the American view, the more influence Great Britain has, the better. And whatever influence Britain has within the EU, Americans are confident would be exercised in a way compatible with American interests. So as long as there's an EU, from a selfish point of view, the United States would rather have Britain in than out. Now, of course, the Brexit issue has to do not with whether membership is in the interest of the United States, but whether it's in the interest of Great Britain. It's obviously for the British people to decide, and they voted once, maybe they'll no. But I also want to say that for people who follow this, a source of considerable dismay is the ongoing shrinkage of the British Army and the Royal Navy. In the Pentagon, they would like nothing better than to have the Navy, the British Navy and the British Army twice its size. That's up to the British taxpayers, of course, but from the American point of view, the use of force is always a possibility, and Britain is historically very effective in wielding force, and the United States and Great Britain have wielded it together, so it's a source of regret that the British military profile is shrinking. And I also was saying to Michael that in the wake of the misadventure in Iraq, in which there were great reservations, not on the part of the British Prime Minister, but in the foreign policy bureaucracy in this country, there people have adopted a kind of informal motto, which a watchword, which is, if the Brits are against it, it's time to rethink. So The United Kingdom has greater influence still in America than you might think, and foreign policy professionals wish that it had more. Now, on a referendum, my answer is that a referendum is, it may not have worked out well in this case for Britain, but it's not anti-democratic or undemocratic. It's, of course, contrary to the theory of representative government, of which Britain has been the outstanding exemplar since, I don't know, 1688. A friend of mine who served in Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet was telling me the other evening that he believes that she would not have been a Brexiteer for a number of reasons, one of which is that she regarded referenda as dangerous and un-British. She said it was foreign, which is to say French. So, but I can't say that it violates the core principle of democracy.
It's more a question of what you choose to have referenda on, isn't it? That's
yes.
the blame
I should say
to direct.
I'm a native of the state of California, and the state of California has had many referenda. And as far as I can tell, they've mostly turned out badly. That is, they've had unintended and unfavorable consequences.
Okay, there's a gentleman there, and then I'll go behind and then I'll cross there. Sir?
Stephen Deal, lifelong Russia watcher. I'd like to come back on your conclusion, which I found very interesting. And I'll use Russia as my particular example, because that's the field I know. Reconstruct containment, yes, I agree. But points two and three, taking steps to weaken those countries, and democracies must maintain themselves as attractive options. this is exactly what Putin has done. He's done step two. He's trying to weaken us, the democracies. And so it makes it more difficult for us to maintain ourselves as attractive options. So how do we seize the initiative back to do these things?
I think that the sanctions imposed in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine and then stiffened with the shoot down of the Dutch airliner are having some effect. They're certainly annoying. And I know that the American passed Magnitsky Act, which targets Russian oligarchs, is a source of real consternation. And we know that because when the Russians tried to contact the Trump administration before it took office, which became a great cause celeb because of the Mueller investigation, their issue was revoking the Magnitsky Act. So I think we're having some effect, and the tougher the sanctions, the better. That, in the end, depends on Europe. The United States is perfectly happy to impose tougher sanctions, and it really depends on the Germans, and the German issues and German attitude is complicated, as you know. So I think we're doing a not bad job, and I've sometimes thought of writing an article arguing that Putin is secretly a CIA agent, since all of his policies are weakening Russia in the long term and pushing it toward the status of a natural resource colony of China, which of course every Russian, even Putin, regard with abhorrence. Their feelings toward the Chinese are not at all friendly. I'm not sure what more it's politically feasible to do, and I'm not in any naive expectation that there will be an uprising. Russians don't do popular uprisings historically. On the other hand, it's been suggested by Russia watchers and people who are more sophisticated than I, although I spent a lot of time watching the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s. I was a senior fellow, as was mentioned, at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and that was my responsibility. So I had a ringside seat at the demise of the evil empire, that sort of once in a century occurrence. The suggestion, and I think it's not impossible, I wouldn't say the chances are great or better than 50-50, but the suggestion is that the regime, certainly the oligarchs, and maybe even some of the Siloviki, will decide that they're paying too heavy a price for Putin personally. And although they want to continue this system, they might decide, they conceivably could decide that they'd be better off with another ruler, somebody like Medvedev, a more friendly face to the West. And in that case, if and when Putin goes, they would be right to think that there would be a possibility for some negotiations that could conceivably ease the pressure on Russia. Now, I'm not saying that that's likely to happen, but I think that it is at least possible, and I don't see any medium-term scenario other than that for changing.
Okay, thanks. Gentleman behind you, and then a gentleman over there, and the lady there. So, sir.
James Kidner from Improbable. We're a technology company that does large-scale simulation, and all this geopolitics is Apple Christopher Arnhill. Riveting talk, and thank you. And I had the chance to look at your book earlier, and clearly we must all buy it. It is quite a short book, for which many thanks. And that leads me to the question, are we, in looking at China and Russia and Iran, failing to look in at ourselves for any, dare I say, responsibility for this mess into which we're heading? Working with very young people, they all, see, all of them half my age or less, twice my intelligence too, are all seeking to blame the problems of the world on us, on madmen like Trump and inadequacy of leadership such as we're seeing here, rather than on them, which seems to be the sort of main focus of your book.
Yeah. Could I invite you to add to that, because it's a question I was going to ask. The economic crisis of 2008, the pressure that put on the Chinese and Russian leaderships, that you said that they both have economic problems, to what extent did the creation of the global crisis, which started with us, to what extent are we responsible partly for that?
Well, let me answer that first. I think that the global crisis It had. The Iranians were not all that much affected because they just export oil. Now, when there's a recession, their exports go down, but already there were sanctions which cut into their exports. The Russians were hurt quite badly. The Chinese managed to survive the crisis, the economic crisis, at least in the short term, by following a policy that might be described as Keynesianism on steroids, and has pumped billions and billions of dollars into the economy, which gave them more confidence in challenging the democracies and their neighbors in the Western Pacific, because the lesson they learned was the American moment is passing more quickly than we thought, and we've got the secret. Yeah. Now, they've stored up longer-term trouble by all this debt, but the democracies, which were appreciated not least for their economic success, took a real blow. Their image took a real blow, so there's no doubt about that. I should say the book, I think, is about 75,000 words, and publishers don't want it any longer than that, to my regret. I cut out a chapter of this today. And this is Oxford University Press, which is an academic press, but also a trade press, and this was published as a trade book. The view that it's all our fault, and I'm happy to go into this, is empirically incorrect. American foreign policy has not been a triumph of good sense or success, but the United States is not responsible for the turmoil in the Middle East. That's the Arab Spring, which had completely indigenous roots. The United States is responsible, or was responsible for the turmoil in Iraq, but even there, a former countryman of yours who became a countryman of mine, named Christopher Hitchens, his name may be familiar, used to make the argument, which is unprovable but not absurd, that Iraq would have collapsed anyway because Saddam and his sons were so awful and so brutal. The business in the Western Pacific has nothing to do with the United States. The United States Navy is upholding international norms and international law, and in the Western Pacific, the other countries of the region are afraid of the Chinese, do not want Chinese hegemony, and want the United States there, and unlike Europeans, are spending more money on defense. In Europe, it should also be noted that the United States, despite Putin's rhetoric, did not provoke the seizure of Crimea or the invasion of the Donbass. And all European countries, to one degree or another, most acutely, of course, in Eastern Europe, and countries that have a border with Russia, are petrified of Russia and want NATO to remain strong and want the United States there. So it's empirically incorrect to blame it on us. And if students or the younger generation does so, it testifies, I'm afraid, and I don't think it's all that different in America, to the inadequacies of their education.
Okay. There's a gentleman over here, and then that way to it, sir.
My name is Raif Armanazi. I'm a former diplomat. How do you answer some those who defend Russia, who state that Russia was pushed into a corner by concerted effort after the ending of the Cold War to push the boundaries of NATO closer to Russia? Wasn't that against the spirit, at least, of the ending of the Cold War? Is that something that's an argument worth putting?
It not only is it an argument worth putting, but it qualifies with me as almost an obsession. I was very active in the mid-90s in trying to stop NATO expansion, precisely for the reason that I thought it would have a deleterious effect on relations with Russia. And I might add that almost everybody who knew Russia felt the same way. The two leading Russianists of their generation were Richard Pipes of Harvard, very conservative, and George Kennan, a former diplomat, very liberal. They were both opposed to NATO expansion. As far as I know, it's the only public issue on which they ever agreed. I can go into the reasons that we didn't stop it. But it was a terrible idea. There's a section on why it was a bad thing in this book, as there is in my last four books, including The Dawn of Peace in Europe, which has a whole chapter on the iniquities of NATO expansion, because we believe that this would turn Russia away from the desire to integrate with the West. And it did so in combination with other policies that the Russians perceived as anti-Russian, such as getting out of the ABM treaty, which were undertaken not from the American point of view, not explicitly as anti-Russian steps. The American government, this was the Clinton administration and the Bush administration, didn't do these things because it was against Russia. In fact, the Clinton administration thought of itself as being very pro-Russian. They did these things because they thought Russia didn't matter anymore. And if the Russians were unhappy, well, that didn't count for anything. Now, anybody with any historical perspective could have told them that that wasn't true, but the upper ranks of the foreign policy bureaucracy in both administrations was populated by people who didn't know this and thought that they could easily get away with it, and they were wrong. So I do believe that NATO expansion played a role, but it played a role in the following way. It turned Russian public opinion, both elite opinion and even mass opinion, against the West, against the United States, and made anti-Western policies in Russian foreign policy the default option. It didn't cause the invasion of Ukraine. What it meant was that when Putin sought to generate nationalist support by invading his neighbor and arguing that it was all the fault of the West, it fell on willing ears. The Russians were willing to believe this because of what they already believed about the West because of this series of missteps, beginning with NATO expansion. As I argue in the book, the West could not have had, I think, a material impact on Russian domestic policy. I mean, Putin is who he is for a whole host of reasons, including personality. But if the West had done what a number of people wanted to do, even people in the Clinton administration wanted to do, and that is create some sort of pan-European order in which the Russians were involved, of which they were part, rather than saying, we're going to expand NATO as far as we like, and oh, by the way, you'll never be allowed to join, which is what they were told. In that case, Russia would not have been reflexively anti-Western, and there would have been some leverage over Russia. Once the Russians were, as Lyndon Johnson said, inside the tent spitting out, he didn't use the word spitting, rather than outside the tent spitting in, it would have afforded at least a bit of leverage. So I think it's at least possible that the invasion of Ukraine would not have happened, although I certainly wouldn't argue that without NATO expansion, Russia would have been a Scandinavian-style democracy. And for that reason, I have argued, it's worth bearing in mind the lesson of NATO expansion, because Russian membership, for Russian membership in a pan-European security order, even in NATO itself, it's both too late and too early. But if and when the Russian regime changes, or even when Putin goes, it's worth revisiting that issue, because Russia's natural place, and the Russians know this, is in the West, not with the Chinese. And so we ought not to make the same mistake twice.
Okay, madam.
Thank you, Professor Mulderbaum. Thank you very much. I lost major part of the lecture due to traffic in London. My name is Mula Zabeleki. I'm the head of the political section of the Greek embassy here in London. But I read more than half of your book already.
Well, it's always a pleasure to meet someone of such intellectual discernment and refinement.
Yes.
And I believe they're recording this, so you can hear the beginning.
Okay, thank you.
Or you can read the book.
I'm reading this right now. I would like to take you a little bit closer to the geopolitical area of my country, the southeastern Mediterranean. For the past 20 years, I personally have been following as a great diplomat the role of Russia and Turkey in the greater southeastern Mediterranean. And I would like your comments on the relatively recent approach, romance between Turkey and Russia. We all know that, of course, the history of these such romances did not really last long. But do you see it, I mean, until last year, most of European diplomats, including many British colleagues here, we considered this romance to be a sort of a very temporary and based on the frictions that Turkey, between Turkey-EU relations and so forth. But I think that we have seen tangible and very solid evidence recently that this romance is more than a temporary romance. And in view of the upcoming purchase, the S-400, and all the fuss in the US Congress, I would like your comments. Do you see this romance sustainable in the near future, or is it just a an Erdogan, let's say, type related project?
Okay, and can we just cover it up with a question which I suspect will have to be our last question, but sir, can we just ask you to take two at once?
Yeah. Don't you think that, sorry, my name is Ali Bahajdu, North South Publication, I'm a journalist. Don't you think that Mr. Trump is trying to reverse every single policy of his predecessor, especially when he appointed John Bolton, who is known for being a warmonger? Thank you.
Okay, on Greece, my sense is that the new Turkish foreign policy is really Erdogan-centered. And that if the opposition, if and when the opposition comes to power, that they would not sustain it. But Erdogan is determined to be there for the foreseeable future, and he's driven, I think, partly by domestic considerations in this direction. He knows that the NATO countries do not approve of his squeezing democracy. And so he moves in that direction. So it could last for some time. I don't think Erdogan is there forever. I don't think Putin is there forever. But they could be there for a good long time and make real trouble. One consequence of Erdogan is that, as you well know, historically, the American and the NATO attitude toward Greece and Turkey is to try to be as neutral as possible, to try to mediate wherever possible. I think that the inclination of the American foreign policy establishment has changed. I can't speak for the Trump administration, but I know people who are Turkish specialists, who've served there, who felt that the Turkish-American relationship was very important, are sufficiently disillusioned with Erdogan to take the position that the tilt toward neutrality no longer serves its purpose. In fact, I've heard a former ambassador to Turkey say, you know, they're really not an ally anymore, which means that insofar as the Greek-Turkish dispute or conflict or whatever you want to call it continues, I think NATO in general and the United States is more likely to be more sympathetic to Greece.
President Trump?
Trump. No, I don't think I don't think that he's trying to reverse everything his predecessors have done. And B, I don't think John Bolton is a warmonger. And anyway, it doesn't matter if he is, because the president has the final say, and the Defense Department has an important say. Now that General Mattis is not there, they've got some guy who's basically a bureaucrat. Strong countervailing force, but the armed services will weigh heavily. So I don't see that as being the case. I've written about Trump, and incidentally, I do write a column a month, and anybody who wishes to be on my distribution list is welcome if you'll give me your email address. My view of Trump has been that three things. First, he in his domestic policies, he's an orthodox Republican. The things that he's done domestically are things that any Republican president would have done. tax cut, deregulation, conservative, just judges. Any Republican would have done that. Second, he's basically a weak president because he's not well informed, he doesn't seem to work very hard, and he doesn't have a cadre of loyalists to seed throughout the bureaucracy, without which you have no hope of making the bureaucracy work the way you want it to. So he hasn't really done all that much, and he doesn't have the potential to do all that much. The exception here is in trade. And Trump has conducted a policy which is different from Republican orthodoxy, and which really has changed American trade policy. And he has somebody working for him, Mr. Lighthizer, who has a reputation of being very competent. In trade, however, and it seems to me that most of it was ill-advised, my impression is that there is a gradual pulling back of the trade threats and trade war against Europe, against Latin America, against Japan. It hasn't come back all the way, but he's been kind of retreating while claiming that he's making great victories. So that what will remain is the new policy toward China. Now, what is striking to me about this trade war with China, so-called, is that it is popular in the United States. The Democrats support it. The Democrats are the protectionist party. The Republicans support it. The Congress supports it. The public supports it. There has been a sea change in the American attitude toward China. And my criticism of Trump is that although he has the right instinct, he's going about it the wrong way. In the first place, he's obsessed with the bilateral trade balance between the United States and China, which is not that important and is certainly not a major offense against an open global trading order. Second, the way to have a hope of getting satisfaction from the Chinese is to form the broadest coalition possible to get all the major trading countries on the side of the United States and formulate demands that they are willing to support, and they would be willing to support some demands, because my sense is that certainly businesses in Europe and in East Asia are unhappy about these mercantilist practices. So Trump had the possibility of forming a broad coalition. Instead, he's gone around imposing tariffs on friendly countries that, by and large, do obey the rules. And that, I think, has been a mistake. I would also mention one other thing about Trump, or two other things. He's quite conflict-averse. He's very critical of the Iraq War. You'll notice that after having threatened Iran with annihilation, he just the other day said he wants to make a deal. He thinks Iran, if they make a deal, they could be welcomed back into the global trading order and they would be great. So that is his inclination. Whether it will be effective, I don't know. The other point I would make about Trump and his weakness is he doesn't control the bureaucracy. And even to the extent that most American presidents do. This is, the Trump show is yes minister on steroids. And that means that in some important areas, and Russian policy is one, the president has one policy, the Congress and the bureaucracy have another policy, and their policy preferences prevail. This administration has been tougher on Russia than Obama was, even though the president clearly would like to be softer. But he just hasn't figured out a way and hasn't tried very hard to get his way. And that's true in other areas as well.
Hmm. Michael, thank you. We have to draw it to a close there. Just before I do, let me remind you about the next meeting of the GSF, which is a seminar on the 12th of June. And it's on the diasporas of Southeast Europe and their role in international relations. It's a joint seminar between the GSF and CSOPS, the Southeast Asian, Southeast European Studies Association at Oxford. And so it's a joint seminar, CSOPS and GSF, on the 12th of June at 10:15, 10:15 to 12 o'clock that day. And it's in the normal room next door, I think, that way. So that's on the 12th of June. Keep that date in mind. But for now, let me thank Michael Mandelbaum on your behalf. I promised that we were going to hear something of tremendous perspective. and he doesn't disappoint. That was, as always with Michael Mandelbaum's work, it's this hard-edged detail coupled with a vision and a challenge. And the book is there, and I challenge you to read it and think about it, because war is not the greatest scourge of mankind. I mean, 1 billion people presently live in this arc from West Africa to South Asia, where war is taking place, ferocious war. But 6 billion people don't live in that arc. You know, there is a sense of peace in the world, but it's theirs to lose. It's ours to lose. And if only we can keep the perspective right and keep the hard edge to our policy, then maybe we can avoid losing it. And for those sort of perspectives, I'm extremely grateful that Michael Mandelbaum was able to make some time today in his trip to the United Kingdom to give us some ideas on that. Michael, thank you very much indeed.